Before we get started with this week's show, we'd like to thank our patrons for supporting Australian True Crime. Alex Riley, Chucky, Joanne Davies, Clooney Fenner, that is such a cool name, Simone Merkett, Lee Christensen, Adam Eckersley, Melinda, Kylie Rose, Claire Bundy, Cindy Lyons, Gabes Ryan, Ursula Janicek, another cool name, and everybody else who has signed up. On our Patreon page, thank you so much for your support. If you're a second tier patron, of course, you're enjoying some extra true crime content. You can do that too, if you want to, for like $5 a month, just by going to patreon.com/austtruecrimepod. That's A-U-S-T, True Crime Pod, but you don't have to remember it. The address is in the notes of this episode. Okay, let's get on with the show.
Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
See, the trouble was with her, she'd never been in trouble with the police. Mm. She had all these different parented kids. Mm. And she was romantically engaged with a policeman from the Brunswick Police, CIB. Oh. And one of her kids got into trouble, and she asked the boss for some money. He said, no, I'm not lending any money. And, of course, because she'd been in the cot with this policeman, she thought, oh, he'll help me. He must love me. He's in bed with me. And he told her to jump in the lake, and so she signed a cheque to get the bail money, and the boss cashed it, and the next thing, the policeman that she'd been romantically involved with came and locked her up and charged her. Oh. And it's a dog's act in my book, but anyway, and from that time on, she just ran amok.
Yeah.
She most probably, at one stage, wasn't a bad sort of a person.
The she in that story is none other than infamous Australian true crime matriarch Kath Pettingill. She is the mother of psychopathic drug dealer Dennis Allen. You can't tell a story about the Australian underworld in the latter half of the 20th century without including Kath and Dennis and the rest of their family. They featured in or inspired every crime book and movie from Underbelly to Animal Kingdom. But the man talking about them in today's podcast knew them better than most. Some said he was too friendly with them for a member of the Victorian police force. If you'd like to know more about Kath and Dennis, and frankly, they're a bit of an obsession of mine, we have an episode all about them. It's called The Pettingills, A Family Born of Crime. It dates back to the 26th of April 2017. So go and have a listen to that. If you'd like to know more about them, they're quite something.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Brian Murphy became a copper not long after my father was born. He belongs to an era tagged either the good old days or the bad old days of policing, depending on whom you ask. But there's no doubting it was a very different job back then, in which officers had a lot more personal discretion and much closer personal ties to the community. Brian's definitely a hard man, but there's a surprising vulnerability that's motivated him throughout his career. And unsurprisingly, he has some interesting insights into the two sides of police corruption and the investigations that follow. The reason we now know so much about this formerly private man is that one of our favourite true crime authors, Vicky Petratus, has written an excellent book about him. It's called Once a Copper, The Life and Times of Brian the Skull Murphy. They both joined us recently, and of course we talked about Kath Pettingill and Dennis Allen, one of my favourite topics, because I know that Brian knew them both well, but he has been accused of corruption where that relationship was concerned.
But there was an accusation made in the newspaper that you took money from Dennis Allen.
Indeed.
How can, can you sue people for saying that in the newspaper? Can people say that about a police officer?
You sue, they can say anything about policemen. But if you sue somebody and you take them up to the Supreme Court or the county court, they may ask you the only question that you can't answer.
Mm-hmm.
And the only ones I ever worried about were the people under my roof and my very close friends. I couldn't care less what other people said about me.
So what do you mean? What's the question you can't answer? What do you mean?
Beg your pardon?
What's the question you can't answer? If you went to the
Well, you don't know. You don't know. So why sue somebody?
So you don't want to put yourself in that position.
In that position.
Right. Okay.
And you might be made look what some people are trying to make you look like.
Yeah. I see. Okay.
And it could open a can of
Pandora's
worms.
Box.
Yeah, got it.
I mean, yeah, certainly I guess it's one of the many, many, many difficulties of being a police officer at that level, being a detective at that level, at the coalface.
You're dealing with human beings. And as I said before, the most important thing in your life is another human being. And if you can't assess a situation and a person as a result of their past deeds and the way they are now, you shouldn't be a detective. But for me to speak with Dennis Allen, I always spoke to him in his house, which was the best place because it was bugged to the max. They had a watchtower in Brighton Maid's factory at the end of his street, and he used to come out in his drunken, drug-fueled rants with a gun and fire at the watchtower. Wow. In Brighton Maze. And a policeman came to me one day from the Commonwealth and said, "Will you tell that bastard to stop firing fucking shots at the shot? Somebody's going to get hurt."
God.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh," he said, "every now and then I don't want them listening to everything I do, but no, I won't fire any more shots."
I mean, this is inner city Melbourne, by the way.
That's right.
This is Richmond.
This is as inner city Melbourne as it gets.
Well, how far away from the city are we? About 2 Ks, 2.5 Ks?
Yeah, we are.
That's unbelievable. What a time.
Vicky, I can tell why you were so intrigued by Brian's story and wanted to write the book.
I wanted to call the book Saturdays with the Skull because I went to Brian's house every Saturday around midday and I would spend a couple of hours. Now, as you guys would know, a book should run to about 80, 90,000 words. And when the book got to 135,000 words and I said to Brian, "You just have to stop telling me stories," because every time I would go back and it was nearly finished and I would fact check, he'd go, "Did I ever tell you about the time?" And then I'd go, "Hold on, I'll just write that down." And so finally I had to kind of pare it back. So, you know, I almost had enough material for two books. But the stories, and if you're a true crime fan, like if you have read the stories of Dennis Allen and if you've read the stories of, you know, Ronald Ryan and things like that, you know, Ryan has a brush with all of these, you know, characters.
It's like criminal history.
Yeah.
When you're reading it, these names that pop up and it's stuff I've heard of, but to actually speak to someone and read about someone who's lived it.
What year did you join the force, Brian?
In 1954. You most probably weren't born then.
No, my dad was born in 1950.
My mum and dad were born, 52 and 53.
Right. And why the skull? Where does the nickname come from?
The lack of hair and different things that happened. And
when you started your policing career, I mean, what's very evident from reading your stories is that policing was very different back then to like how it is now. I mean, you were like old school, you know, had to do a bit of, you know, skirt the lines to get what you needed from the crims.
You took advantage of the cards as you were dealt, and you're on the spot, and if you couldn't call for help, you're dealt with it there and then, win, lose or draw. And in the 50s, policemen had a certain amount of respect. I was trained by ex-lieutenant colonels as drill instructors, as law instructors. And these blokes have been through North Africa, they've been through Borneo, they've been through Greece and Crete, and they knew what being a person in a lawful country, how much it means to them.
Gosh, how fascinating. So they've come from a military background.
That's right.
From an active military background. Yeah. They've actually fought through war, and they've fought through countries without our sort of understanding of policing. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And they were policemen before they joined the army. There was Lieutenant Colonel Coombs. You get a big write-up in Google. And there's also...
on the Wikipedia.
Check that out, yep.
Yeah, and there's also a fellow by the name of Claude Simpson, S-I-M-P-S-O-N, and he was the provost marshal in possibly Cairo, Crete, Greece, Borneo, Darwin, and various other places. Wow. They've both got fantastic... And these are the blokes who were standing talking to you. And I was being a bit of a... I was getting a dressing down one day off Claude Simpson, and he used to spit every now and then. And this is before, when he's speaking to you, you know, and this is before I knew what kind of a good guy he was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was standing in front of him, and I copped a few drops, and I said, I said, "Excuse me, sir." And I wiped my face. Today I feel ashamed for what I did.
Oh, no, darling, yeah.
But, you know?
Yeah. But because, I mean, even when I was a kid in the 70s, there was still such a high amount of respect for war heroes and war heroes from World War II. Yeah. So at that time, so soon after the war, I can imagine these guys were heroes.
And they made you proud to wear a uniform and stand on the corner and run the city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Seems sort of different now, doesn't it? Very different.
They get around like out-of-work truck drivers now with gaiters on and...
Well...
But they... policemen are fantastic. But today they get around with guns and wirelesses and the electronic...
CS spray.
The spray and then the electronic one that I've forgotten the name of it now.
Like the cameras, no?
Oh, everything. And the boss of the walk, they're standing in front of 300 or 400 people demonstrating. They're not allowed to open their mouth. They're not allowed to take, because one of the bosses say, you don't do anything. They go home ashamed. And they go back to the police station, somebody calls them a fat ass to get off their fat ass and do some work. And that's bullying. They take all the bullying in the street, but they can't take a little bit of dress me down and wake up to yourself from their bosses, so they go sick and are suffering from stress. I can't understand that.
Well, what was it like when you were doing protests in the city? What was the brief in the 1950s or 60s or 70s?
Well,
let's say the 60s when the anti-Vietnam protests were happening. That would have been your heyday, wouldn't it?
That's right. Well, I was in plain clothes for a fair bit of that. And I had something on the back of my lapel, make love, not war. And you'd flip it and show the people that were belting the police and they'd go, oh, isn't that lovely? And then bang. It got you into the centre of the crowd. And I got 6 summonses one day from an assault during the Lyndon Baines Johnson episode. And on one occasion I arrested a fellow that had belted his wife, and I gave the evidence in court, and the fellow had a few bruises and scars to show that it had been an altercation, which I wasn't all that prepared to admit, but I had to when he was standing there. And the magistrate told the clerk of courts that I was to go to his office at 1 o'clock. And so I turned up and was standing to attention. And he said, "Mr. Murphy, the Queen in her infinite wisdom gave you a baton to help in the arrest of offenders, not a friggin' torch. I don't want anybody to come into my court that has been assaulted with a torch. He was convicted this morning because it was a bad case," he said, "but I can't stick to you next time." And this is the way the magistrates were. They talk to you.
Yeah.
You know? But everything's so clinical today, unfortunately. Yeah. We've lost the human touch with people.
Discretion is a word we hear a lot, isn't it, from former police? There is very little discretion these days to be able to use that human instinct and human judgment in a situation and decide what's best in a situation. We do hear that a lot.
I think what struck me about Brian's story was that justice was often swift and immediate. And I remember, Brian, the story that you told me about going to your first case of domestic violence and what your senior officer instructed you to do, never get called back twice. Talk about that one.
I was stationed at North Melbourne, which was the first station I ever went to. There's a fellow by the name of Bill Banks. He was the senior constable, one of the senior constables there, now the rank of sergeant. And as it turned out, he was the grandfather of one of my son's wives.
Interesting connection.
Yeah.
And he said, don't wear gloves because they look as if you're going to punch somebody and there might be mittens. He said, if they're not playing up in the street corner, acknowledge their presence, but don't roast them, don't cook them. Leave them be unless they're playing up and then teach them a lesson. He said, if you go to a domestic, don't go back the second time. Give them what they gave their wife and their children.
Wow.
And this is what used to happen. I don't think, I think I went to hundreds of domestic situations. I never went back the second time. The blokes hated me, the wives loved me, and the kids admired me.
In those days, who would call the police on a domestic situation?
Neighbours.
It was neighbours. Okay.
Yeah. Neighbours, the rent man, the bread man, the milkman, the iceman. They were all friends of the police, and they were friends of the people that they were servicing.
So the community was involved in the protection of
A lot more, people. A lot more.
And
now.
You probably knew your community then, didn't you? Like you did have, the milkman come in every day and...
Yeah, and we didn't have this attitude of staying out of it,
The iceman's in the hessian bag. He'd bring the ice in, take the stuff off the top of your fridge, lift it up, have a conversation with the lady of the house, put the block of ice in, get his dinner or a shilling or 10 cents or whatever it was, and off he'd go. And you'd meet him later on in the day and say, you better get down to so-and-so's place. She's got a black eye and she can hardly talk and the kids need a feed. There's nothing in their ice chest, you know. And this is used to happen on a daily basis.
So it really is. It's, all that stuff's really lost now, isn't it?
Gone.
Because we're not as engaged in, we're all busy, and we don't know our neighbours as much.
Nobody wants to know anything. Nobody wants to speak to you because they're frightened to eyeball you. My daughters, if I used to go to the South Melbourne market with my children and the girls would say, Dad, would you stop eyeballing people? I said, what are you talking about? You acknowledge somebody's presence with your eyes.
Yeah.
And they know that you're okay. Margaret and I used to walk every morning at 5:30 and it would be dark and there'd be lots of women walking. And they're by themselves. Now, they had to know that if they saw Margaret and I, they could talk to us.
Yeah.
And I'd say, good morning. Yeah. And there'd be no answer. I'd say, get stuffed. And this is true. And the next morning you say, they'd be the first to say good morning.
They pull back because they didn't
And it's the way it should happen. Because if something bad happens to them, they can come to you and say, can you help me, you know?
The community policing aspect of that's what really impressed me, that, you know, if Brian arrested a husband, that he would be round, and you were well known for this, you know, round at the wife's house the next day with a bag of groceries. So there was never that sense of, well, we'll take away the breadwinner, be he good or bad, but we won't leave you to go hungry.
Yeah.
And your brother, the plumber, had sort of redone bathrooms for, you know, the guy goes
people
into jail
up.
And then, you know, they'll go round and for free sort of put a bathroom in or redo their plumbing
chip
or something.
Bath heater.
You know, so there was this sense of it wasn't just about, you know, carving the numbers into the bedpost of how many you lock up and it was really about making sure that everybody was okay.
We used to pick up the wood from the wood yard on behalf of the, this is in a divvy van, on behalf of the City Mission or the St Vincent de Paul's and all that. The old man was in St Vincent de Paul's and he'd leave a note for me. I might have been on night shift. Can you pick up the wood from the wood yard for Mrs. whatever her name is? And we'd deliver the wood down there. And some of the new arrivals used to put the wood on the front veranda and they'd be selling it around the street to their neighbours, you know. But it didn't make it, and the coppers didn't worry about it.
Yeah.
You know, and if somebody had something go wrong with them, the coppers would go down and give them a hand or take them to the hospital.
So there was a trust and a respect and I guess in a healthy kind of fear of the police.
Oh, yeah. Fear is wonderful stuff. It stops our kids from running amok.
Yeah.
And I was saying to Vicky before, a mate of mine that just passed away recently, he said to me in the car one day, he said, you know, we've been lucky with our kids. I said, no, it's not luck. I said, it's our wives. They've taught our kids compassion, how to speak, how to eat, and all that kind of stuff. So it's our wife that eventually agreed with me. And it's true. And the mothers are the most important people in the world.
As scared as I am of Dennis Allen, I believe that you reckon the most dangerous man you ever met was Ray Chuck Bennett.
Yeah.
Who's that?
He was, God bless him. Now dearly departed, he was most probably one of the most vicious men the Victoria's seen, capable of anything. And
when was the first time you heard of him? Can you remember?
Yes, it was about 1969, 1970. Mm. And a fellow by the name of Palamo, who used to make leather jackets and South Melbourne first and then out in Collingwood, and he had about $6,000 worth of them taken, and it was either Collingburn and Chuck did it.
Geez, that's a lot of money then, isn't it? $6,000?
Oh, $6,000, yeah.
Wow.
And I went to Sydney and they rang me and they said, we've got those jackets. They said, we get 50% out of that. I said, well, you better speak to the owner. We don't work like that down here. You know?
Yep.
So if they've got, they needed $3,000 before they give the jackets back.
Yeah.
And Chuck, I went to his house and with three or four other coppers, and it was a single front of place, and the corridor went down. There's a toilet just outside the back door, and I was speaking to Mrs. Bennett and a nice lady.
Was that his mum or his wife?
His wife.
Yeah.
And another policeman opened the toilet door. Here's the kid sitting on the toilet. The kid's panicked, you know,
yeah.
A stranger. Opened the toilet door and he's jumped out and as he's pulling his pants up, he's running up the corridor. I've picked him up. Quiet in there. Yeah, you're right. I know how to control kids.
Yeah.
Bash them. No, not really. But anyway, I handed the little fella to his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And later in the afternoon, Ray Bennett came home and she could have told him the truth, but he decided because he didn't like coppers, he was going to put a different swing on it, and he alleged that I threw the baby across the room to the mother.
Oh.
I don't believe she would have said it.
Okay.
But that's the story he came to me, and he tried to grab my gun off me that later on that night with another fellow.
Whereabouts?
Beg your pardon?
Where were you?
Myself and three or four other coppers went to the Victoria Pizza on the corner of Peel Street and Victoria Street, North Melbourne.
And how did he know you were there? You always went there?
Bad habits.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's gone there looking for you and you've had a bit of a rumble.
Yeah, I said to the guys, I said, I feel bad about tonight, and they told me that I was getting too old and, you know, too many kids and I worried too much. Anyhow, I went and stood outside.
Uh-huh.
And he pulled up with it in a VIP Valiant that they all drove in those days, and comes over and tried to grab my gun off my holster and all that kind of stuff, and we had a bit of a talk, and anyhow, we took off. And I went back inside and I said, I'm not happy being here, and I sent one of the ropes away for a couple of guns to Russell Street, which is not that far away, and they turned up, and I'm inside. I said, if he comes back and throws a grenade through the window, we're all dead.
Mm.
And so I went and stood outside, and he turned up again with a same armed robber, and they flipped the boot open, they pulled out a shotgun and pointed at me. And with God's grace, about a half a dozen Italian seamen walked out of the market to come into the pizza parlour, and because he couldn't get a decent whack at me. I'm kicking the door, trying to get attention, but they had the jukebox to go inside, and they couldn't hear a thing. And when they eventually come out, the policeman tripped up a step, and the keys went into the gutter, and, of course, they got away.
Oh, wow.
They arrested him on the Monday, and they said to his wife, if the coppers search you, you haven't got the receipt for the shotgun on you. He said, yeah, I have. She said that. And he said, well, tell them you want to go to the toilet. But they were in a room that was being bugged, and they eventually got the receipt for the shotgun because some of the hierarchy police didn't believe that this took place. And later that morning he told me he was going to kill me. I said, well, you made a very bad mistake because you shouldn't have told me that, because now I'll be waiting for you and I'll kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And but I didn't. No. Somebody else did.
Yeah.
But you were accused of it. Like there was a whisper, yeah. Because Ray, of course, went on to do the Great Bookie robbery. He was the mastermind. And
he'd done that before this. They'd done that. And he got out of jail. When they did the bookie robbery, he hit the tow to England.
Oh.
And he was in the cells and they were releasing the drunks. They called the drunk by a certain name, and he jumped up and said, yeah, I'm him, okay. And they bailed him out. He got out of jail.
That's come right. Back here. Yes, I have heard about that.
Mm.
Yes.
And he's an extremely audacious fellow. And when he died, that night, the internal investigations went to my office and they photostated every piece of paper in that place, and because they thought that I most probably was the bloke that shot him.
No.
But I couldn't have been. I wasn't there, and I was elsewhere. But they had that idea, and it wasn't me. It was two other policemen organised it. But anyway, yeah, so there you go.
God, hectic as hell, Brian.
And Michelle, when I was reading the book.
Yeah.
So Brian is known as, you know, a hard man copper, like, let's face it, you're pretty tough.
Easy to get along with certain people.
Yeah.
Sure, and, yeah.
You know, but what I found really fascinating, Vicky, about this book is you go right back to Brian's early life. And I know Brian, Vicky told me that you had a real heart for sort of, protecting people and especially kids, because in a chapter of the book you describe it's incredible writing, but Brian, you were groomed as a child.
Yeah.
And Brian will tell us that story after the break. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Brian tells a story that might change the way you think about inquiries by police into police corruption. But first, Brian tells us about the grooming he was subjected to as an 11-year-old boy.
I used to be an altar boy.
Oh.
God bless me.
Mm-hmm.
And I still hold the same values as that I had then.
Okay.
But I got kicked off the altar in St. Peter and Paul's for knocking a kid out on the altar during Mass. And
what'd you do that for?
Well, they used to have Latin books.
Yeah.
And we used to have to reply the Latin.
Mm-hmm.
All the replies or the responses were in dark ink, so that you know what to say.
Yeah.
And I had something I had to do, and I said, when I got back, this bloke could answer Latin.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't, because I hadn't been an older boy all that long.
Yeah.
I said, give us my book. And he said, no. I said, if you don't give it to me, I'll hit you. And he goes, no. And the priest, old Irish priest, a good bloke, he turned around and said, kick where's your devils. And so we're both looking. I said, give it to me. You know. So I hit him. I must have hit him there.
Mm.
And out he'd gone. He's laying prostitute on the floor. I mean,
prostrate.
Ah, that's the word. Anyway, he's laying on his back. My mother's in the front seat. I can feel these two holes in the back of my neck.
Yeah.
I thought, well, I'm in big trouble there. And anyhow, he gets up and he's wandering around like a drunken sailor. And I'm still answering the Latin because I have my book. And when it comes to communion time, we used to have the rails and everybody kneel down to receive communion and hold a plate, gold plate under their chin so part of the host didn't fall anywhere.
Yeah.
And there were some shocking tongues you had to look at. Oh,
yes.
God.
Yes.
Anyhow, I get to my mother and she just goes, I'm going to kill you. You see? So I thought, here goes. I chucked the plate right into her throat and I thought, I might as well cop her for that as well. You know? But anyhow, that's, and I went into St. Francis.
Right.
They got me in there.
And that's where the
guy, there used to be right just over near Michael's camera store that is now.
Yeah.
It's Ted's camera store, and there used to be a shop there, fresh fruit drinks and pineapples. And, beautiful, you know. And because they're Cosadina, and my brother and I, we used to share our fares. We'd walk into St. Francis from home and save the money, and then we'd almost have enough. And the bloke used to say, give us 10 pence instead of a dinar or a shilling. And anyhow, we go over there one day and he says, oh, g'day, boys. This bloke said, g'day, and how are you going? And not bad. And I thought, he's a decent sort of a bloke. And when he came to pay, he paid for the lot. And I thought, shit, this is all right. But it wasn't. And it got to the stage where my mother and father were a bit concerned about him, so they went in to meet him, and they thought he wasn't a bad bloke either. And
he'd come and meet you, wouldn't he, after church?
Yeah, devious mongrels they are. Anyhow, he said, I used to love going to church, and I used to go and do benediction at 4 o'clock. And some people, I think one of the other churches called it Vespers and that, and it was all, to me, it was lovely. And anyhow, he saw me there a couple of times and he took me down to the corner of Little Collins Street and Elizabeth Street. He used to go downstairs to a big kitchen there and they used to serve you bread. I'd never seen bread like it in my life. I'd only seen it, stale bread or fresh bread, you know, and because we were pretty poor and the Italians were there and with the big bread and the soup. And, this is living. A serviette, you know. Anyhow, he started going to Grove. I had my brother with me one day and he kissed me and I thought, Jesus, this is not good, you know. I could be in a bit of strife here. So I didn't tell my mother and I worried about it for about a week and Buffhead, my brother, Kevin, he's a good bloke, but he wouldn't have understood what was going on. He's 3 years younger than me. What was I, about 10 or 11 or something then? And so he took us to a place in South Melbourne behind where my brother eventually bought a shop. Every time I pass that, I feel sick, even now.
Yeah.
But I was so lucky. Anyhow, arrangements were made for him to come for a meal, and he's sitting at the table. Mum's carving the meat, as she did, and she sees his hand go under the table and he's going to grab on me. They were audacious. They could never believe how audacious they are. Anyway, she's said, get your bloody hands off on the table. And with that, you could see the stark terror in his eyes. They crystallised like Tom and Jerry, you know, when the cat's eyes pull apart. And he's up, and he's grabbed his coat, and she's chased him out the door with a carving knife.
Yep.
And she got me in the front room. We had was a little lounge, and my dad was there. Oh, my dad went to jump up from the table. She said, "You sit where you are."
Yeah.
Well, she was in no mood. And I will look after this. And she chased him, and she got my dad and myself in there, and she said, "You've done nothing wrong."
Oh, bless her. Yep.
You know.
Yep. You were worried about that, weren't you, that you would be so angry?
Yeah, I was going to go to hell and all this kind of shit.
Yeah.
But it was actually did me good for the future.
Mm.
And I was very aware of my own children. I wanted to know where they were. There were no sleepovers because you don't know if some dad's going to come home half drunk and do anything or even kill them, you know. So, and they were my responsibilities. My wife said, the kids used to say, oh, but Dad, you know, other kids do it. I said, I'm not their responsibility. They're not my responsibility. You are. And the way it turned out, it most probably stood me in good stead as an adult.
Who was that? Who was he, Brian?
Tell them about the time you met him again as an adult.
Oh, no. Yeah, I was about 11. When I was 21, I became a policeman, naturally, and I was patrolling Elizabeth Street between Flinders Street and Lonsdale Street. That was my beat, you see. Anyhow, I'm walking along and I get up near St. Francis there, about half a block away from where St. Francis is now, and I spring this bloke walking along with a kid in tow, and the mother and father walking behind. I tweaked him as the mother and father, and I walked up and I said, is this your child? He said, no. And the mother said, oh, this is our little boy, you know, blah, blah, blah. And with that, I said, you take the little kid. And I've given him a thunderclap across the face, open hand, and I reckon I started it off from St. Patrick's Cathedral and travelled there. And I thought every bone in my hand was going to fall apart. Mm. And then I gave him one from the other side, and he started to run away, and I said, I hope you run in front of a friggin' bus, because there were all buses in Bourke Street in those days. And I've never seen him since or heard of him.
So he would have kept around the churches picking up like St. Francis.
Terrible people. God, it doesn't make any difference whether you've got a mother or father or your single parent, you know. They just zoom in.
Do you think he recognised you?
No, didn't have a clue. Didn't have a clue, and I'm glad. And then I'm walking back to Russell Street, and I thought, well, there you are. You've only been a couple of months in the job, and you're going to get the arse, and they'll find out that you've did it. And, you know, this. And I walked in, and the boss said to me, and what have you been up to? And I'm thinking, oh, geez, he knows. I said, just doing what I did. He said, good, get around, have your meal and get back out in the street again. And I'm going, whoo.
That's incredible, isn't it, that, you know. But that, I just found that extremely powerful in the book.
I visited a mate of mine in prison, and I met this priest there. And I said, g'day, Father, how are you going? I knew him as a kid. I said, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm visiting Michael Clennon.
Oh, yeah.
You see? I said, that bastard? He said, who are you visiting? I said, I'm visiting Paul Higgins. He said, they're both prisoners. He said, they're both human beings. And I said, oh, shit, eh? And that was it. And I told Higgins about it. He said, listen, we're all prisoners in here, mate. He says, and I found the bloke okay. He's a dog, but I found him okay. And so, you know, that's another prisoner's, and he was a copper, very hard.
Yeah.
And but a good bloke, and it cost them $33 million to send him to jail.
You mentioned him
what's his story?
In the foreword of the book, Brian, don't you, Paul Higgins, to the memory of one of my dearest friends. So tell us about Paul.
Is he no longer with us?
Big pardon?
Is Paul still living?
No, he's dead.
What happened?
Cancer.
Oh.
Through worry.
Yep.
He was, there's a bloke by the name of Fat Harry Bennett, or TAA, Terras Harry. He was a commander in the police force. And he was a part of a group of men under a superintendent by the name of Harry McMenamin. They're all dead now, so you can please yourself what you think of them. But they were dogs. And Harry McMenamin used to organise criminals to break into banks, to do armed robberies, to do all kinds of things. And he had a squad called the Breaking Squad, of which I was a member some 20 years later. And they used to give criminals, safe cutters and breakers and all that kind of stuff, cover, so that if the local copper come along, they'd say, hey, we're watching this bloke, piss off, you know, everything's all right. And the coppers wouldn't know any different, but the bloke doing the job was working on behalf of the police department or the policemen. Paul Higgins, Fat Harry asked him, Fat Harry gave me the job of getting rid of the Vietnamese that were robbing the Chinese and bashing them senseless in Chinatown after the gambling, Fan Tan and all that kind of stuff. And he said to me one day, he said, Murphy, he said, I've given you a good job there. I said, thanks, boss. He said, you go down and tell all those bloody chows at each restaurant that I want a box of the best red and a box of the best white each month. He said, okay. I said, yeah, that'd be beautiful. I said, but every bastard knows that I don't drink. So they all say, there's something going on here. We don't like it. And the next thing, we've got everybody investigating you.
Mm.
I won't tell you. I won't tell the boss who put me up to this. And straight away, he could see that he couldn't really trust me all that much. So he said, just forget it. But he was still frightened of me. He went to Higgins one night and he said to him, I want you to collect from the parlours each month.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and we'll divvy it up. And Higgins told him to get fucked, which was a mistake, because once he told him that, straight away he'd become somebody that could cause him embarrassment. And so from that time on, Paul Higgins was a target. One night he went out with a walkie-talkie radio, working by himself, in and out the nightclubs, checked him at D24 on several occasions, anything doing for me. But he most probably checked in, say, at 4 o'clock in the morning, and 4:05, there's a stabbing in the New Warwick guest house down in Beansfield Parade. He would have been 100 yards away from him. He would have bitten the arse at the backside out of a criminal, because he couldn't have helped himself. He would have gone there. But because they couldn't find him, they set him up and they charged him with being absent without leave and all this garbage, you see. And he came to me and he said, what'll I do? I said, what you should do is, the bloke that investigated you is no good. I said, and he's taken a fortnight's leave, and his secretary, he's taken away for a fortnight. He's taken a month's leave. He's taken her away for a fortnight, but he told his wife he's going to Sydney for a trial, you see.
Okay.
And I said, I'll get a mate of mine to surprise him if he gets to go. Follow him, photograph him, photograph the books, the names they went under and everything. I said, in the day of the court, get a Spirex bound and say, boss, this is your life. I said, he'll either have a frigging heart attack or he'll go sick.
Oh, my God.
And you know what Higgins said to me?
What?
I couldn't do that to another copper.
Oh.
I said, good on you. You're a whacker. But we were still the best of mates.
Yeah.
Anyhow, eventually I got told that they were doing an inquiry on 4 policemen. I was one of them. And the bosses kept telling me, we're not after you, we're after Higgins. I kept telling Higgins. He said, that's bullshit. They're not. So I told him about various criminals that made statements, and one of them was in the cells one night. He went over, he said, no, it's bullshit. I didn't make a statement about you at all. Once Higgins told the boss to get nicked, that was it. And they worked on him, and it cost them $33 million to get him into jail. Now, if you watch, there's going to be a series coming on soon, and they've had an ex-chief commissioner, an ex-assistant commissioner said, we investigated Murphy to the max, and we couldn't find anything wrong with him. Most probably because there's nothing there, right? But they said we had plenty on Higgins. So they put this superintendent in charge of the inquiry, and they sacked another bloke who was an honest fellow, and this bloke let them go on with the prostitutes, take statements which were bullshit, and they convicted him of a lot of perjury, and they got him 5 years.
Oh.
And all that worry killed him. And when he was dying, I said to him, he said, mate, it's all over now. I said, oh, yeah.
He says, I think I lost all the hate. I said, get fucked. I said, I'll hate him for you. I'll hate him for you. And we took his, Margaret and I took his mum up to the jail every month while he was in the can. And
so after $33 million, all they got him on was perjury.
Virtually.
Is that what you're saying?
No. Plant, they gave him 5 years for planting explosives in a joint, which two other coppers said he didn't, that they'd done it and he didn't know anything about it. And 2.5 years for something else. But it was...
that case nearly bankrupted the police association.
It did.
I think they, after that case, they capped... you know, they kept the amount of money that they could devote to people.
Yeah, but, mate, if you're in a union like that and something goes wrong, bugger it if you just up the ante. But one of the blokes that objected to Paul Higgins being funded and very vocal finished up doing 5 years himself.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
That's Brian the Skull Murphy, who is the subject of Vicky Petratus' new book, Once a Copper. We've honestly just scratched the surface of the incredibly entertaining yarns featured in that book, so do go out and buy it. But I have popped one extra little bon mot on our Patreon page for our second-tier patrons this week. It's the Boofhead Henderson story, which features a cameo appearance by Ronald Ryan, the last man to be hanged in Australia. And if you're a second-tier patron, you'll also find out which infamous Australian hitman Brian's wife Margaret found quite handsome when he sat in her lounge room waiting to kill Brian. Brian didn't come home in time, and I'm assuming Margaret didn't realise that that's why the man was sitting there when she found him handsome. But, I mean, who knows? I don't know the lady. But if you haven't signed up already, you might want to swing by patreon.com/osttruecrimepod. That link is in the notes of this episode. And sign up as a second-tier patron so that you can get some extra Australian true crime goodies in your life. We're very close to hitting an exciting Patreon milestone, actually. So to celebrate, we'll pop a copy of the book, Brian the Skull Murphy, Once a Copper, in the post for our 500th patron. I'd say that person will most likely sign up sometime today. We'll be back next week with a very interesting episode with one of Australia's most controversial true crime experts.